From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Today, we're talking about la muerte. We'll remember those who touched our lives and celebrate rebirth.
I feel much stronger now. I feel like there is always somewhere that I can turn to if I always feel like weak.
And contemplate the animals and plants that have to die to give us life with an elk whisperer.
Yeah, that's like the big boy of the mountain.
Nuestro show para el Día de los Muertos, the Day of the Dead, today on Latino USA. Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa, and this week we're talking about death. First up, death in politics and policy. Does immigration reform still have a pulse, or is it among the walking dead? You've already heard a bunch of views on this.
Is immigration reform dead, or is it just hitting a speed bump in the Senate?
Well, I'm afraid we're not going to know that until we see the end. But
the bill is proof. The art of political compromise is not dead.
Man, this thing's dead.
It's dead.
It's dead.
Of course, this movement is far from dead. It's alive. It's well.
The movement is clearly alive and kicking. And President Obama continues to say he's making immigration reform a priority to the degree that it's possible. Just last week, building on political capital from the shutdown battle, the president said,
"It's good for our economy. It's good for our national security. It's good for our people. And we should do it this year."
In this round of the discussion on the issue, the president's enthusiasm seems to, for once, be shared by some Republican legislators. Congressman Jeff Denham of California is co-sponsoring a Democratic bill that incorporates a path to citizenship, mirroring the Senate's version. Congressman Daryl Issa is backing legislation to provide legal temporary status to undocumented immigrants. And just this past week, hundreds of business and community leaders, many of them conservatives, went to Washington to demand that there be movement on immigration reform. Bob Narabout was one of them. He's the executive director of the Idaho Dairymen's Association, and he joined me from Washington, D.C. Bob Narabout, welcome to Latino USA.
Thank you very much, Maria, and thank you so much for this opportunity.
So tell me a little bit about the Americans for Reform event and why you decided to get your organization, your association, involved in the event.
Sure. The Americans for Reform, and it's about 600 or 700 people that came in to lobby for immigration. We're at the cusp of the immigration debate. Time is running short for this year, and obviously our concerns, both from a business perspective and a humanitarian perspective, is it's time to move immigration forward. Idaho, where I come from, is a very strong Republican state, and right now, quite frankly, it's the Republicans that is our focus and our target. The purpose and the reason they got involved, you can go down two or three different prongs. You can look at the business need for immigration reform, or you can look from the moral aspect. And really, our board really got engaged after an incident that occurred in about 2007 in Twin Falls, where the majority of our dairy industry is located.
What happened in Twin Falls?
In Twin Falls, and I want to say this was about 2007, et cetera, there is a grocery outlet store that a lot of the Hispanic community, Latino community shops at. We did have a case where ICE did park outside the facility, and if you came out of the facility and you were brown skin, you were stopped, you were asked for your papers, et cetera, and a lot of people were picked up at that time. A strong portion of my board is of Dutch descent, and it brought back memories to the board members from their parents or their grandparents about what was happening in Holland during World War II. where people, where the relatives were required to carry papers. And they just found something outlandish about that, that people, because of the color of their skin, would be targeting. One of our key board members at that time had an employee who had been with him for 15 years. He asked an employee, and the employee's name was Daniel. He said, "Daniel, how is the Latino community handling what happened over at the grocery outlet store?" Daniel said, "If we're both deported at the same time, are you going to take care of our children?" That kind of hit home. Individuals were no longer having the freedom to be in society and immersing themselves in society. That stimulated some studies done by our board using the University of Idaho. What was determined was not only is it a crisis for that individual, because if they're afraid to be in society together, they're afraid to go to church together, they're afraid to be involved in school together. That's when we got established and really started focusing on immigration.
So what do we need to know about the milk that we drink and how immigrants play a role in all of that?
If you go to Idaho, I would say roughly about 90% of those working on dairies would be foreign-born labor. And so as you drink that glass of milk, you need to recognize that without a strong immigration program, that glass of milk will no longer be able to be made in the United States, that we'll have to rely on other countries to bring that product to us. We have our choice. We can either set up a strong immigration program or we can import our food. So we have a lot of food and a lot of growers in the United States, not just dairy, but other products, who are looking at other countries where the labor force is available and saying, okay, if I can't get the labor force here, then I need to go where the labor force is. So that's kind of the option from a business point of view.
Bob Narabout, thanks so much for joining us on Latino USA.
Thank you very much for the time.
Bob Narabout is the executive director of the Idaho Dairymen's Association. He's part of a group of business and community leaders that went to Washington to push for immigration reform last week. I'm a New Yorker, so even when I'm not in mourning, I love wearing black. And whenever I see Latino teens dressed in goth garb, I feel a kind of kinship. I mean, I dressed in black punk in the 1970s, people. So I have been fascinated with Latino goth culture for a long time. And so today, in honor of all things goth, we have the stories of three Latinos, Pablo Pofald, Susie Exposito, and Nadia Raymond, who found a sense of community in this counterculture at some point in their lives.
Hi, my name is Pablo. I'm 31 years old. I am from Indiana in a small town, but my parents are from Chile, and I now live in Salt Lake City, Utah. I would say I definitely grew up feeling fairly, individualistic and different from the people around me, especially growing up in a small Midwestern town. I think as I got older, I was definitely more attracted to, you know, subcultures and such that felt like they were sort of embracing of, you know, either different political views or different aesthetics or something that just sort of felt a little bit different than what I felt to be mainstream style or music or, you know, art and such. You know, I started exploring things and, you know, got really interested in Nine Inch Nails. Through him, I got drawn into, you know, larger pockets of industrial music and electronic music in general, and, you know, started wearing black because I thought it looked cool and I liked the aesthetic in general and combat boots and things like that, colored hair, all that sort of stuff. It felt like different from quote unquote mainstream culture in the sense that the majority, you know, of people around me were not necessarily wearing lots of black and listening to super dark music. But at the same time, there were quite a few kids that were. So it wasn't necessarily that I felt like I was into something so different from everybody else, but it did feel like I had discovered a style and aesthetic and music that really appealed to me and my personality and, you know, felt good.
My name is Susie Exposito and I'm a former Hmong goth. I would describe a mall goth as a young person who might go to the mall for no other reason besides terrifying all the people who go to the mall who are not goths. I was bullied for a variety of things. Like, I was like the shortest kid in class. I also got made fun of for like having really thick eyebrows. And I just got all this like negative attention anyway. So I decided to kind of own that by becoming this, like, kind of terrifying girl. It started with music, really. My parents really liked Nirvana, but also they really liked Depeche Mode and The Cure and Morrissey. And apparently, according to a lot of my other Latino friends, that's actually really common. Like, for whatever reason, Latinos love Morrissey, and nobody really knows why. I think it's the melodrama. I just listened to what my parents listened to, and now I'm really proud of the way that I pulled off being goth and being Latina. I basically reinterpreted chonga fashion in a really goth way, so I like to call myself a chongoth in that time period. Because I had like this dark brown lipstick, I plucked my eyebrows really, really thin and kind of like drew them on. And now I'm really proud of that. I'm glad that I didn't completely succumb to my peers who just insisted that I was too ghetto and too ethnic to be a goth.
My name is Nadia Raymond. I am Latino USA's music consultant. You usually don't hear me, but if you hear music, and especially if you hear music and you like it, then you hear me. Why do Latinos love Morrissey? This is a question that has troubled the ages since the beginning of time. I don't really know why we love Morrissey. I think it's partially a combination of the extreme earnestness of Morrissey is kind of like similar to like mariachi lyrics. Like there's a lot of like heartache and opening your veins and spilling your blood to show the person that you would rather die than be without them, like that type of thing. I think that appeals to our some like part of our brain that grew up listening to that in the background. I also just think that we all like the pompadour. It's just very much an awesome fashion statement that we can all relate to. Rock music in general at that time in Latin America was really popular because I think rock music sounds to us and has similar beats and similar structure to a lot of just a combination of African musical roots that we all have because of slavery and because of immigration. And it also has lyrical basis that are very like emotional, heartfelt music, even when sung with like a heavy beat. So there's always like, you know, a physical manifestation of all these cultural tastes. I think that for goth kids, it just happened to be a way for them to be able to self-identify and let other kids that shared those cultural tastes see them and find community that way.
One quick programming note, The Graduates, Los Graduados on PBS. This past week, they premiered their documentary on Latinas and the pressures they face in school. Check out latinousa.org for a link and let us know if you've been watching Los Graduados. And coming up,
I started calling elk when I was about 15, and I've been doing it ever since.
Traditional hunting, with respect for the animals that die to sustain our lives, on El Día de los Muertos special on Latino USA. No se vayan.
Van a ser las 10 y
Welcome back to Your Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa, and coming up, a conversation with writer Eduardo Galeano. But first, when we sit down to dinner, we rarely think about death. I mean, what a downer, you know? The truth is that most things we eat were alive at some point. It's another way that death begets life. Just ask Mark Casillas, a hunter in New Mexico, with an incredible skill that honors his family's deep-rooted tradition of self-sufficiency. Latino USA producer Michael Simon Johnson has our story.
Mark Casillas' Spanish is not very good.
Todos los guías que nosotros tenemos trabajando aquí habla inglés, habla español.
But his elk is incredible.
My name is Mark Casillas, and I'm an outfitter. I'm the head of hunts for the Quinlan Ranch out here in Chama, New Mexico.
Yes, that's Mark making those bizarre sounds. He's a hunter.
Deer, antelope, bear, ibex, oryx, Barbary sheep, turkeys.
But elk are his specialty. That's why they call him the Elk Whisperer.
All my family from way back were hunters, you know, grandfathers, great-grandfathers.
My grandfather, great-great-grandfather.
His dad, my granddad, my great-granddad.
They all hunted.
They were great hunters.
That's Mark's wife, Melissa.
Six-time New Mexico State champion archer.
And her dad, Gia Mondragon.
Melissa, yeah, she's a good hunter.
And hunting?
That was a big part of the way of life, you know, in New Mexico.
This part of northern New Mexico, with its 200-year-old colonial churches and store signs still in Spanish, is somewhere between 80 and 90% Hispanic. Many folks here, like the Casillas family, have been living off this land since the early 1800s, before New Mexico was even part of the United States. Ranching, farming, and fishing still fuel nearby towns, and cattle use the roads as much as cars. For Mark Casillas, a ninth-generation descendant of the Spaniards, it's hunting that's the link to tradition.
I started calling elk when I was about 15, and I've been doing it ever since.
Back then, he used some unconventional materials to make his calls.
Duct tape, Coors cans, and condoms.
Yeah, all this mountainous stuff that you see, the mountain part.
We're driving through the Quinlan Ranch, the one Mark works for. It's 17,000 acres of sprawling mountainous terrain.
See, and all the way back to those fields back there, that's all part of it.
A lot of New Mexico is flat, red desert, but the northern part of the state, at the foothills of the Rocky Mountains, looks more like Colorado. Green, wooded, rugged. Mark and I are headed out for an evening hunt.
So, anyway, let's go.
He takes us past a fence into 3 square miles of dense forest called the Trophy Management Area. We're leaving society and entering the elk's world.
Stand by that tree.
Mark calls and the elk respond. But we have only a general sense of where the elk calls, the real elk calls, are coming from. Yet every exchange gives Mark more information about where they are and who they are.
We got a bull. Seems like he's about 300 yards up here. We're going to work our way up, set up, see if we can't call him in. Come on.
From a distance, it sounds like we've awakened some kind of mythical beast from a deep slumber.
There was two of them. He's showing his manlyhood. He's wanting the cow.
So Mark impersonates a cow.
And what I'm doing is I'm trying to create excitement. Watch, this one's coming.
Mark is genuinely communicating with these animals. But more specifically, he's, you know, putting the moves on these elk.
Yeah, that's like the big boy of the mountain.
And a female response would be sort of like,
oh, that sounds so cool. I'd love to see your place.
See, Mark has all these characters that he plays. Viral bulls, cows in heat, lost calves. And he uses these characters to convince the real animals that he's not just one of them, but that he's a whole herd. A herd that doesn't actually exist. In other words, Mark is a con man. A bull in his prime steps out of my imagination and into the woods. Elk look similar to deer, but shaggier, bigger. 5 feet at the shoulder, head and antlers can add another 4 feet. This one is tall and elegant, with a brownish-gray coat and a crown of antlers. It's amazing to me that he can hold all that weight on his head. He looks skeptical. He thought there would be cows here, but clearly there aren't any. I don't know how well our camouflage jackets are hiding us, whether I should fear for my own safety. All I know is this guy is more majestic than I could have ever imagined. Mark readies his rifle, an old-style single-shot firearm that he loads with gunpowder down the muzzle. It's his favorite way of hunting. This elk gets to live another day. Today, Mark is just demonstrating, but on most days, he would make a clean kill. And not only that, he charges a good deal of money to take people along so they can kill too. Clients pay for a license to kill a single elk, and the bigger the antlers, the higher the price. One time, a hunter paid $40,000 for one kill. It's true that Mark makes his living off of killing animals, but he says that hunting helps him connect with the natural world in a meaningful way.
I've hunted with guides from all over the country. In my eyes, the best hunting guides are the people that were born and raised and live in these mountains. They're mountain men. They're great woodsmen. To me, it's in your blood. It's in your past. I mean, it's in your genes.
And in his family, hunting will survive into the future.
I love hunting. I live for hunting and fishing.
Before I leave, Gia, Mark's father-in-law, takes me into his garage and shows me one of his trophies, a bull's head hanging on the wall.
And that guy, I said to myself, I'm going to mount this one here. Might be the last big one that I'll shoot in my lifetime. So there he is.
But as Gia Mondragon sees his hunting career wind down,
Sierra, she's growing up that way.
His granddaughter, 7-year-old Sierra Casillas, daughter of Mark the Elk Whisperer, is just starting hers.
Amazing.
She's already killed a porcupine.
Just without a read, without anything, and they answer her.
For Latino USA, I'm Michael Simon Johnson.
And she was having a blast.
I was a college student in Latin American studies in the 1980s when I first read the book Las Venas Abiertas de América Latina, The Open Veins of Latin America, by internationally acclaimed Uruguayan writer Eduardo Galeano, who is one of the most talented and prolific Latin American writers of his time. He's published over 40 books, been translated into more than 20 languages, and at 73 years old, is still writing. Now, Eduardo Galeano joins us to discuss his most recent book, Children of the Days, A Calendar of Human History. Eduardo, you are something of a recurrent presence on my radio show, Latino USA. We've had you on many times over the last 20 years, and it's just wonderful to have you back in New York City and in our studios once again. Bienvenido.
Yes, I'm happy to be with you again.
You do not stop producing, Eduardo.
I'm very slow to write, you know.
Your new book is called Children of Days. It is literally a calendar. What is your process of writing?
I don't know how it happens, but stories touch me, telling me, write me. I deserve to be written. I deserve to be told.
So you,
I am a good story to be told.
So you actually feel like you're a vessel, and you suddenly these things just appear, and you're like, I have to write this.
And then I begin writing.
The book, A Calendar of Human History, Children of Days, is in fact structured like a calendar, but you know, you could read it every day, certainly, because there are short snippets for every day. You had a favorite entry day. December 18th.
Yes.
And you want to read this, so I'm going to let you read this because clearly this entry, which is happens to be International Migrants Day of the World, share with us what you wrote for December 18th.
The first excels. Today, December 18, International Migrants Day, is not a bad moment to recall that the first ones in human history obliged to immigrate were Adam and Eve. According to the official version, Eve tempted Adam. She offered him the forbidden fruit, and it was her fault that both of them were banished from paradise. But is that how it happened? Really? Or did Adam do what he did of his own accord? Maybe Eve offered him nothing and asked nothing of him. Maybe Adam chose to bite the forbidden fruit when he learned that Eve had already done so. Maybe she had already lost the privilege of immortality, and Adam opted to share her damnation. And so he became mortal, but not alone.
Why is that such a favorite for you? You're trying to say, don't forget.
Don't forget it. Because in the Genesis, you were guilty. You women were guilty. And we male were victims. And for me, it's very delightful to rewrite history in the opposite sense. Saying no, it's exactly the opposite.
Now, one of the things, you know, Eduardo, when I was reading your book, when I first came upon you, you know, in the early 1980s, people talked about Uruguay, and it was almost like, Uruguay, where is Uruguay? And Uruguay, people didn't even know how to pronounce it. Well, your country has really transformed. Your president, José Mujica, has one of the most fascinating profiles of any world leader. He donates 90% of his monthly salary. He drives his own car. He lives in his own home. He is a man of the people. So just at this moment in history, we never did think that Uruguay was going to become this incredible symbolic and a place to follow. What's that been like for you, Eduardo?
Well, he is a friend of mine, so I cannot speak about him as a neutral observer of reality. He's a real person, not a character. He's not a theater actor playing the poor president, the only one who's not exhibiting his power and his richness and so on. No, this is real. He's like he seems to be.
Did you ever imagine that your friend, José, your buddy, would end up becoming the president of Uruguay? Was that ever in your imagination?
Not really, no. No, because he didn't want to be president, not at all. But finally, all his friends pushed, and we finally got it, which doesn't mean that I agree with everything he's doing. For instance, in relation with nature and mines of forest enterprises, and well, that, there are a lot of things, themes, subjects in which I disagree with him, and it's all okay. I mean, when I was the last operation I had, I was waking up from the anesthesia, and when I finally woke up, I opened my eyes, and it was he, the president, sitting in my bed, sitting there. And then he said, get out of here. You are our president. Go on to governance. What are you doing here? I'm just visiting a friend.
Oh my God, that's a good friend. Eduardo Galeano's latest book is Children of Days, A Calendar of Human History, and it is published by The Nation Books.
The Nation Books, yes.
Muchas gracias, Eduardo. So good to see you again.
And you.
Thinking about death can be heavy, but almost death can sometimes be a pit stop to a rebirth. a chance to remake yourself, to start again. Here on Latino USA, we talk a lot about issues around immigration and mental health. So our ears perked up when we heard about a documentary focusing on a young Latina immigrant who opens up about her personal struggles by using theater. The film is called Trust, A Second Act in Young Lives. In it, an 18-year-old named Marlene tells her personal story of immigration, rape, and substance abuse to a group of teens. Then they all work together to make a play out of her life story. Here's a clip of the Chicago-based theater company founder, David Feiner, prepping teens before they hear Marlene's story for the very first time.
Asking that person, inviting that person to share his or her life is a sacred responsibility. Listen to the story as an artist. So as somebody who's going to possibly be working on making a play out of the story.
So I'm just going to ask one thing. I don't want you guys to remember me like this. I want you guys to remember like you met me and just the way I am without telling this.
And so begins the Albany Park Theater Project process. The young people, some of whom are eighth graders, handle Marlene's story with respect and a sense of responsibility. Since the movie Trust began screening around the country, other young people have seen something familiar in Marlene's journey. Theater professor Jesse Carlo featured the film as part of a workshop he did with Latino teens from around the U.S. His audience was attentive and engaged with the story. The teens related to Marlene not just as a Latina, but they also related to her
as an immigrant having taken the journey to El Norte, you know, making her way to the United States of America, all of the things that happened to her on her journey. You know, they see a portion of themselves in her. And I think that that kind of connection is also essential. But here it really touched home for many of them. And I know that they either know people who have parents, family members, sisters, brothers, whomever they might be, friends, neighbors, they know how dangerous this journey is.
Filmmaker Nancy Kelly remembers watching the theater director talk to staff, worried by the intensity of Marlene's story. Could the teens handle the experience? Turns out it wasn't the first time the company had dealt with young immigrants.
David reminded them of how in the history of the theater company, they have done this over and over again, taken stories told by individuals, often immigrants, who feel powerless. And the process of creating the show is empowering that the storyteller and the members of the ensemble come away from the creation of the play feeling like they have control over the narrative of their own life.
Marlene, who doesn't give her last name, says the project gave her something she needed when she was starting over in a new place. It showed her that she wasn't alone.
I hope that this documentary speaks for many other girls out there, or even, I don't know, whoever, and that if they can relate to it, I hope that it does any good to them. It definitely did something for me. I feel much stronger now. I feel like there is always somewhere that I can turn to if I always feel like weak. I hope that this is speaking for like the many other girls who felt like that, not just me.
Trust is available to stream through the America Reframed series on the World Channel. You can also find out more information about Trust, the film, on our website at latinousa.org. And coming up on Latino USA, what's life without the occasional goosebumps?
Usted cree fantasmas?
Some of our favorite horror movies creeping up on you. No se vaya. Aquí.
Siempre que estoy bien.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Today, we're talking about death, or La Pelona, as we call her in Mexico, the bald one. And in Mexico, we often laugh about La Pelona. So today, on our Latino USA Día de los Muertos special, we invited our two favorite funny guys, Lalo Alcaraz and Al Madrigal, to give us their take on the topic. Here for their regular segment, we give you Al and Lalo.
Thank you, Maria. I am comedian Al Madrigal, and I'm here with my good friend,
Lalo Alcaraz. I'm the creator of La Cucaracha and Pocho.com.
And together we are here for another segment we're calling Latinos from the
Future.
Keeping with the theme of today's show, we're in the season of the dead.
That's right. It's all about death around here.
We just had Halloween. By the way, what did your son end up going with? I know he was debating about his costume.
Yeah. He originally thought of something vampiric, but I know he's annoyed by his sister's love of Twilight. So he went with undead postal worker.
My daughter ended up going with cotton candy.
Yeah.
Which is
like,
cute.
My wife made it.
Yeah, pink. Yeah, she had a little headpiece. She ended up looking like a troll doll, really. That's all I care about. And then
Did you get her big contacts or her eyes or
wide?
Well, exactly.
And then my son ended up going as Beaker, which is from the Muppets, which is great. But speaking of costumes,
Yes. Is
it okay for you to dress your son or daughter up as a different ethnicity for Halloween?
That's an interesting question, Al.
Because a woman in Asheville, North Carolina says costumes like the Cherokee Cutie, which features a very short dress, are demeaning.
Yeah.
I think it's demeaning just because of the short dress.
Yeah.
But likens the costume to blackface.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So, correct. I mean, when you have a geisha girl or a Cherokee Cutie.
Or Cherokee Princess, which I'm surprised that's not the costume.
I think that's what it is. A lot of little girls want to dress up like an Indian princess.
Or Pocahontas. I guess in the context of historical figure, it might be okay, and you give it that respect.
But is your kid going to go as a geisha girl or a Chinese railroad worker?
At my kid's elementary school, I've seen kids with the little hop-seeing outfit come in, and actually they do a whole kung fu fighting song.
For all the ninjas
to
come out?
Yeah, they dance around to the song Kung Fu Fighting. They're all dressed as Asian kids, and no, I am not Asian, and my school is not an Asian school. So, yeah, it could be cute, but it could be problematic also. You know, we should strive to be better here, and at least talking about it's the first step.
So talk about it, folks. Before you dress up your child like a coconut or a milk dud or a geisha girl.
Or a magic eight ball.
Maybe you should discuss it and see if it makes anyone around you uncomfortable. Well, what about a little check-in on our good folks at Disney? Because
that's right. Disney Company trademarked the term Día de los Muertos, or Day of the Dead, the Mexican holiday.
You can't say that anymore because they were successful and we're going to be sued right now.
Luckily, it did not turn out that way. There is a movie. There are three movie projects actually out there on the Day of the Dead theme. Disney has theirs. Of course, they go out and trademark the title of the movie. Somebody at the legal department didn't really double check how problematic this could be to people in the Mexican-American community.
So someone in Disney Legal attempted to just completely trademark the name.
Blanket
trademark over the name Day of the Dead. That's what they
wanted. The uproar was so great that Disney withdrew its trademark application.
How do things even get to that stage? That's another thing that's problematic is that there's so few Latinos working in legal at Disney or just in the planning stages of any of these projects.
That's right.
That they can't tell people what's right and what's wrong and how the public could react, which by the way, we should make our services available. We are available to consult corporations. If you're trying to appeal to the Latino demographic, we're here. Latinos of the future can help you.
We're already there in the future.
We're in the future.
We'll tell you what happened when you screwed up and didn't hire us. So,
keeping with the theme of the dead.
Of the dead, yes.
Let's talk about careers that are dead.
Oh,
and,
my.
A Texas teacher is facing heat for activities she participated in outside of the classroom before working with students. Christy Nicole DeWeese, 21, a Spanish teacher at Townview Magnet School in Dallas, was featured as Playboy's co-ed of the month in 2011.
My. So she was involved in collegiate activities.
Co-ed of the month.
She was in college.
College girl.
God bless her.
Yeah, exactly. She needed to make a little money.
Student loans are crazy expensive.
According to the New York Daily News, DeWeese posed nude for the magazine and was shown wearing a winter bunny outfit and simulating lesbian sex with another model.
Well, was there an anatomy lesson to be gleaned from this?
Maybe the other model was dressed as a carrot. Who knows?
It's the cycle of life.
When parents discovered the sexy photo shoot, which, by the way,
what parent discovered this?
Ooh, how dare she? I was casually flipping through my uncle's catalog of old Playboys, 2011 Playboys, yeah. Not even classics. Who saves those? And discovered my son's Spanish teacher. What did she do? They complained to the administration. Oh,
I'm sorry, but that dad knew that the Spanish teacher was quite a looker already.
Sure.
And
well, that's, I think, the problem with this hot teacher. People are looking for an excuse. A 21-year-old that is a Playboy-quality looker teaching your son or any other student Spanish, yeah. I mean, it's got to put—
That's like three layers of sexy right there.
It really is. So they got rid of her. But
career move.
I would like to— I should hire— my Spanish is horrible. We've talked about this.
Yeah.
I should hire Ms. DeWeese, right?
Sure.
Or maybe we should start a network of sexy, sexy Spanish teachers.
I'll call my mom.
Yes. I think it's got to end with I'll call my mom. That has been another Latinos from the future. Back to you, Maria.
You can hear Al and Lalo talk about the Day of the Dead and the artist José Guadalupe Posada on our website, latinousa.org. And now, the movies that scare us to death. Okay, the truth is, I'm a real wimp when it comes to horror movies. When I was 8 years old, I saw Drink the Blood of Dracula, and after that, the door to my bedroom was always open, and the light had to stay on, despite my dad's quejas about the electric bill. But I am fascinated by people who have no fear and get a particular kind of joy from watching terrifying things. People like filmmaker Edwin Pagan, who loves horror films so much that he started a website about it in 2008. It's called LatinHorror.com. Edwin Pagan also runs screenings of Latin horror movies twice a year at the Anthology Film Archives in New York City. One screening is called Cinco de Miedo and coincides with Cinco de Mayo, and the other one is Time to Halloween and El Día de los Muertos. Today, he's here to talk with us about some of his favorite examples of Latin horror. Welcome to Latino USA, Edwin.
No, thanks for having me and that wonderful introduction, Maria. It's great to share.
I mean, just having to write it, I was like, oh my God, I was so scared back then. So you decide to create this project, the Latin Horror, LatinHorror.com, and you have this film festival. So when you come to selecting movies, what are you looking for?
What I'm really looking for are films that have a voice to them, meaning it's not just to be scary, but you could tell that the Latina director have something to say that's new and also grounded in our idiosyncrasies, because I think that, you know, we believe in our culture that the spirit lives, that there is something else, whereas in other cultures it's about negating the fact that it exists to the very end of the movie. And we believe from frame one in our movies, as do the Japanese, that there is an entity, that there's a ghost. What we want to find out is, why is it after us? And it becomes more fun that way.
Right. So Guillermo del Toro, this is his quote. He says, American horror destroys the body. Latin horror destroys the mind and the soul.
I mean, exactly.
I'm more terrified by the thought of destroying the mind and the soul.
Well, it's no different. Like in our culture, we have the chupacabra. We have the stories of El Cuco. El Cuco, you don't know what it looks like. People will say, oh, si no te portas bien, te va a coger el cuco. If you don't behave, the cuco will get you. but they never say what it looks like. So your mind fills in the blanks. So whatever your worst fear is, it's what the cuckoo becomes.
Oh, my God.
And so you can imagine as a child in your room when they tell you that at night, you're looking at every nook and cranny in your room and anything could be el cuckoo.
Right, but modern Latino parenting, you know, it's kind of like, no, we're not going to say those things. But anyway, let's move on to some of your favorite Latin horror movies. The first one we're going to talk about brings back Guillermo del Toro. Now, most people know Guillermo del Toro because of his very scary movie, Pan's Labyrinth. But the movie that you actually like most of his is The Devil's Backbone. So lead us into this clip, Edwin.
The Devil's Backbone is one of his earlier pieces. And it's about a young boy who is taken to a convent and starts experiencing the spirit of another young boy who kind of befriends. But there's a mystery. There's something that's happened in that convent, which the boy starts realizing, and other things start happening because other people don't want him to find out.
All right, let's play the clip.
¿Usted cree en fantasmas?
Ayúdame.
Yo creo que he visto uno. Aquí.
Oh, my God. I needed to pull my headphones off of my ear. I just can't. Ayúdame. Oh, my God. So why is this one of your favorite horror films?
One of the things that I like about Guillermo is that he'll do a tentpole film like he just recently did Pacific Rim, and then he'll always do a personal project. And these smaller indie films, he is home. He is back to doing the thing he loves best, which is filling it with metaphor, with folklore. So you can see that it's grounded in the historical content of the time, but he also goes in and he'll give voice and character and fleshes out the ghost just as much as he does the little boy who's the main character.
Okay, now another one of your movies that you picked as one of your favorites also takes place in Spain and involves an orphanage. It's called El Orfanato, and it was made in 2007 by Spanish filmmaker Juan Antonio Bayona. The plot is that a woman returns to the orphanage where she grew up to turn it into a home for disabled boys. And while she's there, her own son sees a young boy, then he disappears. So we're going to listen to this clip, which is near the climax of the movie.
Un, dos, tres, toca la pared. Un, dos, tres.
And you're just like smiling away. I like jumped up against the wall. What is it about this movie that makes you love it so much?
The mother is played actually by Belén Rueda, who I have like the most biggest crush on. I love her in so many films. And she plays the mother to perfection. And one of the things actually that happens that's interesting in the film is that the ghost, which the parents first think is like the imaginary friend, turns out to be a real child that lived in that facility, which she actually knew when she was there as a young lady.
Well, Edwin, thank you so much for scaring me. And
my pleasure.
And thanks for holding on the fort on Latin horror. Edwin Pagan writes all about Latin horror movies at latinhorror.com. Thanks again, Edwin.
Thanks for having me. And there will be sangre.
Oh, God.
La muerte. Death. It makes us do strange things. Lately, I found myself staring out into space and then being very grateful for every breath I take. Yes, some of this year's muertitos have been deeply personal, like Elaine Rivera.
What's happening with young Latinas is there's tremendous pressure put on them that many young teenagers don't have to face.
Elaine Rivera was a trailblazer Latina in mainstream print media, a hard-nosed journalist who was always speaking up for the underdog. And because of that, in the predominantly white male newsrooms of mainstream print media, Rivera was often seen as having an agenda, which broke her heart. Elaine Rivera, we will miss you deeply. There were other deaths this year, hundreds more of unnamed people, men, women, and yes, children, who died trying to get into our country. According to the National Foundation for American Policy, in the past year, there were 477 deaths along the border. Others who left us changed our lives with ideas and words, like Oscar Hijuelos, the first Latino to win the Pulitzer Prize. We interviewed him on Latino USA in 2002, and he told us about finding his muse.
I listen to a lot of the la música that, you know, of the old days, of the turn of the century.
In many ways, those who passed away in 2013 reminded us of the broad cultural impact Latinos have had in our country. The great Jenny Rivera was a star singer, actress, and Latin Grammy winner. And Lupe Ontiveros died at the age of 69. You saw her on TV or in the movies, where she boasted about having played over 150 maids in her acting career. I interviewed her in 2008 for my PBS show, One on One.
Well, there's so much to fight for, you know, just to stay alive in these times that we're living. But I think I'd die sooner if I was peaceful and calm.
Another person close to our Latino USA family was Maria Tapia Belcito, who we lost just last week. Born in Ecuador, she lived in Kansas and then moved to New York City, where she worked in our offices. She was most proud of her daughters, Monica, Cristina, and Vanessa, and her husband, Bob. The tradition of having a tight-knit, unified family was the most important thing to her. Adios, MTB. Our querida wordsmith, Dolores Prida, left us in January. Dolores Prida wrote plays like Coser y Cantar, and as we celebrate the lives of our dead, I remember Dolores's last celebration. She died one night after dancing and eating guava pastelitos at a party with longtime friends from a group called LIPS, Latinas in Power. And I'm thankful that a holiday that no one knew about in this country 25 years ago is now celebrated everywhere. El Día de los Muertos gives us the chance to never forget nuestros muertitos. And as all things end, so must our show, queridos. But all things begin again, so join us again next week or check in with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr. Latino USA is produced by Carolina Gonzalez, AC Valdez, Lita Hartman, Marlon Bishop, Michael Simon Johnson, Daisy Rosario, Brenda Salinas, and Michael Jones. We had additional engineering this week from Brendan Baker. Nadia Raymond is our music consultant. Jonathan Wolf and Eva DeLapp are interns. And Nancy Trujillo makes it all happen. Thanks to Alan Minsky and KPFK in Southern California. Our show was founded at the University of Texas at Austin, and I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. And I'll see you on my personal Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and be back with you next week to talk all about mujeres.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, dedicated to achieving a more just and equitable society for all. And the Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide.
Funding for our series, Radio Nature, is provided by the REI Foundation, supporting today's youth to develop a lifetime commitment to nature and the outdoors.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Lumber Liquidators, offering a variety of sustainably harvested flooring, including pre-finished and stained, at 1-800-HARDWOOD. The Pew Charitable Trusts, working to help states provide voters with timely, accurate election information at pewtrusts.org. And the Annie E. Casey Foundation, developing solutions to support strong families and communities for America's children at aecf.org. This is NPR.